I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Joining me now is the poet Stephen Torr. He has just published a collection of poetry, Red Obsidian, New and Selected Poems. It is a collection of poetry that takes us into the wilds of the Canadian and American Wests, providing a look at the landscape as well as the animals, human and otherwise. I got a sense of how much work there is outside, chores and the sort. He evokes that in his words. Some of Stephen's poetry looks at environmental degradation as well as romantic relationships. Stephen Torr joined me from Port Townsend, Washington, nearly 3 weeks ago. He's lived throughout the Northern California coast as well as here in British Columbia, like Salt Spring Island, where he usually lives. He's lived off the grid in rural locations, and his working life has included college teaching, counseling, family services, farming, and construction. This new book is published by University of Regina Press. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Stephen Torr. Mr. Torr, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We were talking just before we started. I enjoyed the book because your use of the language, your ability to commit poetry is just, it's vivid and it's evocative, and I enjoyed it a great deal because of it. It took me to places that I'm otherwise unfamiliar. So I guess the first question is how would you describe the poems in this collection?
Oh, gosh. Well, they vary a lot. I think one unusual thing about that book is that they're stylistically over a pretty broad range, but I guess they're held together by the landscapes that they're tied to, because I'm tied to landscape, to the outdoors, and how would I describe? I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know how to summarize it. I mean, there are certain themes that, you know, some reflections on gender and male labor and love and loss of the environment, loss of people, and love of people, and love of the environment. So I guess those are the main threads.
Yeah. So we're talking in mid-March, and there's a poem where you equate sort of winter with death, which you know, makes sense, because that's when things die off, and then I guess spring is the reborn of the rebirth of life again. Is there a season that you enjoy more?
Oh gosh, I think that you may be referring to an old poem in which I was actually celebrating winter. I think it may be one when I was out cutting firewood, and it was just so exhilarating when I was ranching. I felt some of the deepest exhilaration, and frankly, the most time to write in the dead of winter. You know,
yeah.
what indigenous people call the time of keeping still. I mean, everybody loves spring. You know, I'm chomping to get up to Atlin and northern BC and get out on the lake and fish and go, you know, hiking with my wife. But I love it all. I don't have a favorite season.
Yeah, I never liked winter for the longest time. And then as I was reading that poem in particular, it made me realize... You just mentioned the art of keeping still, and that puts it into perspective, because I think throughout the year we're going places or we're doing stuff, and then I live in Vancouver, and so when it snows, you know, 5 centimeters, everything shuts down.
And you see some new opportunities
exactly. That's made me, well, especially since we've been spending a lot of time at home in this past year, it made me realize that because I've learned to enjoy, you know, the isolation, if you will. It made me realize that it's a good time of the year to be inside.
Well, and it may be, since so many people are so stressed and complaining, and you hear reports of mental health issues.
Yeah.
that people have not learned to develop a productive, nurturing solitude. Maybe that's something that's kind of indicative of all of the complaints and the restlessness that people have. I mean, I think it's legitimate, but at the same time, maybe it points to a deeper need in a large part of the population.
Yeah, exactly. And this goes to another point in the book that I found throughout. I mean, you have such a reverent view of the outdoors, or romantic view at times, and it made me realize that there's a lot of work to do outdoors, a lot of chores and things like that. Do you always enjoy that sort of work? I guess it's necessary work, isn't it, right?
I feel like it's fundamental. I mean, I think we were given bodies with appendages to make things and accomplish fundamental tasks. So I'm sort of anti-urban and anti-technology. I'm not anti-machines, but, you know, as Thoreau said, we become the tools of our tools. So, yeah, I think, like you mentioned, this poem, that old poem about getting firewood, I think that's a meditative, enriching, and fundamental thing that I think we were made to do. And I think embracing work and understanding that it's pretty fundamental to the way our bodies are constructed is, I think that's important.
You mentioned being anti-urban a moment ago, and I'm curious to know if you understand why some people might not have sort of the view of the outdoors that you have.
Oh, sure. People need entertainment, and every people, I think, including myself, are prone to addictive comforts and the avoidance of work. I mean, we all have a bit of laziness. I don't know if that relates to the question, but I'm a country guy, I spent plenty of time in cities. I mean, so and I can enjoy them for a few days. I'm fed by the outdoors, and I'm fortunate, you know. I realize that I'm a very lucky guy. I mean, when I look at the world and try to imagine the grief and strife and malaise of the world, I realize I'm the book this book of mine and my work is are reports of a pretty privileged guy. I don't take that for granted. I think I'm just a damn lucky guy.
So if the outdoors is where you live, if it's your lifestyle, what do you make of people who think of it as an escape for themselves? I mean, is it something that you welcome? I mean, in this past year here in British Columbia, for example, those of us that live in cities, we're always looking to somewhere else in the province. A lot of the places where you've lived over the years, whether it's on the island or up north, as places to go for vacation. How do you view that sort of interloping, if you will?
Joe, it's the history of humanity's always sought the comfort and solace of nature. People have always sought that. But, you know, it comes down to what are our lives doing? What are we doing for community? And people in the cities, and I've worked in cities, in small towns, mostly. Well, I've worked in bigger ones, too. But it's a question of, are we fulfilling our obligations to community? Are we being just incredibly selfish and self-centered about wherever we live? So I don't think it's a matter of escape, but I think it is important to ask ourselves, are we escaping our community responsibilities? Because I think we all have them. And certainly many people fulfill them in incredibly admirable and productive ways in urban environments.
But what about people who would rather, you know, see a parking lot in the middle of a forest or something like that? I mean, how hopeful are you about the future in terms of the protecting our environment when there are people who are less inclined to do so?
I'm worried about it. It's a huge problem. I mean, it's not just parking lots. It's all the, you know, the toxicity Of course, I'm worried about that, and you know, I think cities have to be redesigned to a large extent, just deconstructed, torn down, and rebuilt, so that there are open spaces within the city, and as well as protecting what we have left that's not in cities. And fortunately, in B.C. and in Canada, there's a heck of a lot of it. And so, of course, I'm concerned about that. That's just basic environmental consciousness.
But do you think, are you optimistic, though, that the rest of us should be as concerned, say?
That's a great question. I can't say yes to it. I'm not, history doesn't make me an optimist. but I am, you know, I was talking to a fellow the other day, and what really does sort of mitigate my pessimism are young people who are incredibly and vigorously awake and living with great consciousness and awareness of the environment and of one another. So that's a kind of caveat or a kind of a counter to my reading of history and the trajectory of human choices, which are generally driven by greed.
Yeah. In terms of the poetry in this collection, do you write, say, influenced by the sort of poetry that you enjoy reading?
You know, Joe, I'm going to admit that I don't read a lot of poetry. I'm much more interested in essayists and particularly writers who are writing about the environment and teaching me something about the environment that I don't know, which is a lot. Writers like Robert McFarlane, his fairly recent book, Underland, you know. Uh-huh. I love and am inspired by the selfless voyaging that he does in the world, and so I'm not influenced by other poets much anymore. I mean, some of them have helped me break loose and explore, which is, you know, our fundamental job as writers is to keep exploring and keep shedding our personae. But I think it's essayists and environmental writers that are more, and even some fiction writers.
Uh-huh.
I recently met Annie Proulx, and I just, you know, I love her.
Yeah.
That huge tome, that Barkskins book that she, her last book. So, yeah, poets are often just too self-centered, and it's a very, it's dangerously self-centered work, poetry can be, and has been historically. So, I don't really, you know, rush around to find the latest books or poems. In fact, quite the opposite. I'm probably uninformed and less informed than I should be about the vital voices that are around us now.
So when you write poetry, when you commit poetry, that's obviously a solitary experience. What time of day do you work best, say?
morning. Mm-hmm. And I used to write, and probably still. I'm not a disciplined guy. I don't consider it a career. It's one of the things I do. I consider myself a maker. I make things out of wood and out of antlers, and I can build, and poetry is just one of my essential needs. But morning is when my brain is most awake.
Right, right. Do you have certain tools? I mean, you mentioned, woodworking. I mean, there are certain tools one needs for that. In terms of writing, do you have certain things that you use? Like, do you use a computer, for example?
Well, I was a long time. I still scribble on yellow pads. I recently was reading Obama's book.
Oh, yeah. He
still says he likes to scribble on pads. And he's a pretty poetic guy, actually.
Indeed.
But I have to say that the beauty of the computer, there are many great things about that tool, but seeing things on a screen is, I've learned to see it as a page, and I have to see it. I have to see something as an artifact, and that's, it's almost an artifact when it's in black and white up on a computer screen, for sure.
Yeah, you mentioned yellow pads. I'm that's the only thing I really use when I write, and I sometimes you go to the store and you see the pads that are white, and they're definitely not the same.
No, I don't like white ones either.
Yeah. And it's something about the paper as well, the thinness of it that I don't know. I'm looking at some of the notes I wrote as I was reading your book, and they're, I took them to the computer later and typed them up, and so they're on, regular white paper, but I still have my yellow, the stuff that I ripped off the pads, because it's a process that my mind works better, I think, when I write stuff down.
Interesting, Joe. Yeah, to think about what significance is the yellowness. You're talking about the thinness of the paper.
Yeah.
So there's something more tentative and ephemeral about it. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Why do we like yellow more than a white pad? But I'm one of those, for sure.
In terms of reading poetry, I mean, you talked about your relationship with other poets and other poetry a moment ago. There was a great line in one of your poems that made me laugh out loud, and it's... how many would memorize some Yeats just to get laid? And I'm laughing because I gave a speech once at a wedding. A friend of mine got married, and I quoted Yeats. I've never read Yeats other than I heard a line of Yeats in a eulogy, and I thought it was about friendship. So I decided to put that in my speech, and everything else that I said. No one remembers that other than that, oh, he quoted Yeats. And it's funny how people, seem to have a certain, I guess, awe for Yeats, who probably haven't otherwise read him.
Well, I think a lot of guys think they can impress a woman if they can read a little poetry or have an interest in poetry. gives you...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it certainly worked with that wedding speech. That people, people would ask me about it later, and
They asked you about the poem or the lines you read, or what was it?
Well, it's just someone came up. I remember a person came up to me and said, "Oh, you quoted Yeats. That was quite nice." And I swear, Steve, that nobody. Or that person had never read any other Yeats in their life.
but they knew he was a significant 20th century poet. Anyway.
Yeah, indeed. So, which is fascinating. I mean, it just speaks to, you mentioned about, other, what the world of poetry. It's had its effect on people who don't even read poetry.
Okay.
It just struck me as, but it's a great line though in that poem in this book that I had to write it down on my yellow foolscap and bring it to this conversation.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks for checking the book out. I mean, it was hard. It's been a lot easier talking with you than it was a fellow. Actually, I don't know, it was yesterday. It was this week. So it must have been yesterday and Monday. Because he's a nice guy, but he hadn't looked into the book, and I found myself stuttering with trying to respond to questions like, where are you from? And I know those are impossible questions for me to answer, really. And
I have one question in terms of where you're from, but because I was reading up on you, and you know, you went to Berkeley, lived in Washington State, Montana, Michigan, even, and then
Wisconsin.
Oh, Wisconsin. Pardon me.
Yeah.
And then on the coast, on one of the Gulf Islands, and then you mentioned Atlin a moment ago. It seems that you've moved north as you've gotten older. What's brought you up to, say, British Columbia?
Well, I came, you know, I'm an old guy, back to the land guy, you know. I was milking a goat when it was hard to find a good milk goat. But the first thing I did, I mean, the most formative part of my life was on a big lake, one of the biggest in the American West, up in Montana. That was the critical beginning of my life, and now I'm back on the biggest lake in British Columbia, and that's home. So it's kind of from lake to lake, and in between I've lived on the coast in some pretty spectacular places, Big Sur and Mendocino and places like that.
Yeah.
But I've had a relationship. My daughters were very, very small, just toddlers.
Uh-huh.
I moved to the Robson Valley, you know, up the upper toward Jasper on the Fraser, and that was what drove me. You know, I want to raise my kids in a wild place. Although I've gone back to the States and done various kinds of work, I've always had a kind of bipolar life and by country life, back and forth, but now it's pretty settled in BC. I'm married to an amazing painter, a BC painter, Judith Corelli, and she's just an amazing partner, and I'm, you know, home is Atlin. We're there for more than half the year, so I'm, you know, as I say, Joe, I went from the lake of my early boyhood to a big lake of my adulthood.
Yeah, you mentioned your wife, and you talk about her at the end of the book about how really to get motivated, I guess, to finish writing and the sort. She's important to you that way, isn't she?
Oh, incredibly so, and incredibly important in getting to Atlin. I really wouldn't, you know, I'd known about Atlin for a long time, but hadn't gotten up there, and really it's, I always say to my friends, she brought me home, because she's a longtime resident there.
Yeah. In terms of what it's been like this last year, a lot of us are complaining about, you know, things that we haven't been able to do. How have you found it, living through the pandemic?
Well, for me, you know, it's not been that different. I certainly can't, you know, I have lots of things to make out of, you know, I'm a woodworker, and so I'm busy, and yeah, the social distancing has been curtailed a lot, and I mean the socializing has been yeah. limited, but yeah. But I don't suffer from it. I don't feel like, I mean, I'm looking forward to it ending, and I feel for those who have suffered. But I can't say that I have that much. It's not been a big deal for me.
You mentioned woodworking a moment ago. We talked about it earlier. Is it at all like crafting a poem?
Oh, interesting. Good question, Joel. Well, in this month, see, I used to salvage really big trees, you know, big giant redwood trees, and I salvaged them out of the woods, but also out of the ocean and out of river mouths, and I would slab them into big slabs, and every time you pull one of those slabs off and sweep the sawdust out, you know, you're kind of like opening a new chapter, opening a page. There's always a kind of mystery about it, and a richness, because the wood has its own story and its own richness, particularly the kinds of logs I was cutting into. So in that sense, there's some similarity, but it was easier. It was a lot easier than finding the right words, because the tree would give its poetry. It was already there, or its story, or its beauty. It was already there. All you had to do was cut into it, and it revealed. Whereas a blank page is kind of like, well, sometimes I call it a wobbly mirror. I call it a lot of things, but it's also kind of like a semi-translucent skin that's crawling with larvae, and you got tweezers, and you're trying to pull the larva out, and you got a big stack of tweezers at your elbow, and a lot of what you pull out are dead larvae. So it's quite different from opening up a tree and just appreciating the beauty that is there. I don't know if that's answering your question, but I thought it was a good question.
Oh, well, makes a lot of sense, and it makes me wonder then how you view your own poetry, in terms because it obviously is craft as much as art, isn't it? I mean, do you view it as art at all?
It's a practice. I call it a practice of wakefulness. So it's a practice of trying to be awake and trying to discover. And the weird thing about it, about language, is that if you sometimes find the freshest, most original and most poignant expression in language, you're finding a kind of meaning. And that whole process is art, I guess, or it's imagination. You know, the traditional Inuit didn't have a word for art, I don't believe. They had a verb, which was to work on. So, again, we're back to making. So it's a process of making, and it's a process of wakefulness, I think. And then if our first job is to be awake, and then our secondary job is to make reports of it sometimes. We over-license ourselves to give those reports. So I don't know. I think, you know, there's nothing lofty about it. It's like Neruda said in his acceptance speech in 1973 when he won the Nobel Prize. But he said, although I'm not sure I totally believed him, because he had a pretty big ego, but he said that the poet's work was no more lofty than the baker who consigns his dough to the oven and, you know, to make bread for the community. And I feel that way about poetry, really. It's kind of gotten glorified by poets. I don't think it's very glorified by the population, because I don't think they read that much, and uh-huh. perhaps there are good reasons for that.
Yeah.
Well, no, I don't know.
Well, I've enjoyed reading this book, and I appreciate your time today, because it's been a pleasure speaking to you about it. All
it's been
the best
a pleasure for me, Joe.
Well, I appreciate that. All the best, Stephen, and continued good luck with the book.
Thanks, and let me know about this. I might want to hear what I sound like. This is a new experience for me. Let me know how to access this. And thanks for your work, and thanks for supporting the book.
The book is called Red Obsidian, New and Selected Poems. It is published by University of Regina Press. Its author, Stephen Torr, joined me on the line from Port Townsend, Washington. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunta.